see so many people again to consider the Dhamma. I'll be going back to England Thursday morning, so it's nice to be with you again. One of the recurring themes in my own mind about spiritual life and Buddhism is how very, it seems to me, how complex our society is. And my beginnings in Thailand were in a very, very simple agrarian society. And there's a nice story from my third year there. We had we were starting a new monastery in the northeast, and Ajahn Sumedho, our American teacher, was the abbot there. This is the first time he was the abbot of a monastery, and it was the first time I think a Westerner was going to be the abbot of a monastery in Thailand. And there were about 15 of us or so, and we had a small meditation hall, and someone in Bangkok had donated a Buddha rupa, which is about 10 times the size of the meditation hall, something very appropriate. And then someone, I don't know who, built this huge plinth, this sort of massive plinth. And the villagers, this Buddha image was delivered to the train station, which was about 3 kilometers or so from the monastery. Big Buddha. And the villagers took long bamboo poles and they put this Buddha on these long bamboo poles, and they must have had about 30 or 40 men, and all the women were saying go for it, and they carried this Buddha image all the way to the monastery, which is really very inspiring and very kind of communal kind of thing to do. Lovely. Well, they got to the monastery and they brought inside this meditation hall with a big plinth, and there was all these Westerners, us, and they put it down, and we all started to argue about how to get winches and pulleys and tripods and what it weigh and who's going to do this anyway. And we're all kind of sort of semi-arguing, debating with this, and all of a sudden the Thai man just took the thing and put it on the plinth. which is great. It's just brute strength. Go for it. We'll do it. Bang. And that sort of was a kind of indication of our, you know, where we Westerners were at. So a good intellect, it can be very helpful for all kinds of things, but it can be also a very complex thing to deal with. And just like in the spiritual life, I was talking with Andre about, say, modern drugs that exist for all kinds of things. I remember in New Zealand, there was a man from a traditional Buddhist family who had a bipolar disease, and his doctor, I think, advised him that he could go off the drug, and which was an unfortunate decision because he just lost it, completely lost it, and he lost his wife, he lost his car, he lost his job, he lost everything, and the monastery was the last place he could go to, and I felt totally overwhelmed by his energy. He was very kind of megalomaniac kind of energy, but I tried to take care of him and so on. Eventually we got him to the hospital. And they got him on his medication again, and 3 or 4 months later, he was back on his feet again. And a year later, he had a job. He didn't get his wife back, or his car, but he did get a house, and slowly, slowly, his life was on track again. And I was very inspired by that. I could see how I couldn't have done that, or the practice of awareness couldn't have done that. So I thought, yeah, it's really wonderful that some of these medications that do exist. But then also we have misuse of medication too, don't we? And we certainly read a lot about the misuse of medication. So just around, like, it's very complex, all of that. You know, that's like there are these good things, and then there's the kind of overuse of Prozac, I suppose. I don't use the stuff myself, so I'm not quite sure if there is overuse or what, but certainly one reads about that. And say in literature, like in literature, I was just in Chapters with Andre, and there's a lot of books there. I think our library at Amaravati has something like 20,000 books. And people who are new to Buddhism just faint when they go in there. They go, where do I start? And not just Buddhism, of course, you have psychology and you have all the other kinds of traditions that go on. So just in the amount of information that's available, very complex, there's a lot. Meditation techniques. You have books from all the masters and different people teach different things. Spiritual supermarket kind of stuff. Just to say, use of computers, the use of our the kind of scientific mind that we have so much. There's a tremendous amount of that. So what I find is we are very complex beings. Our culture is very complex. We tend to be like issues. We like to debate issues. We like to do that a lot. And so what I find quite often lacking in my own development and in the kind of development of my fellow monks and nuns in the monastery and people I meet is the simple things like faith and devotion. These very, very, very simple things, but actually very, very important things in the spiritual life. And I often ask that, and I've often asked that in these meetings, is what do you have faith in? And what do you trust in? You trust in your brakes. Otherwise you don't take your car out. Trust is something that does exist. Sometimes we think, well, I'm not really a faith type, but obviously you have to have faith to do anything. You have to have some sense of trust to be with people or live with people. And a very complex situation where there are a lot of options leads to a lot of doubt, option paralysis. The sense of which one should I do, how should I do it. Faith without intelligence, of course, easily goes to superstition or goes into naive kind of action or impulsivity. So faith alone or just some kind of trust without intelligence is an imbalance. But just having a lot of ideas and not being able to act, not being able to stay with a commitment, say, that also has its problems, obviously. That also has its drawbacks. One of the things people often ask me is like, what do you do in the extremes, when life is extreme? When the family's going through a lot of turmoil, when there's a divorce, or when there's no work and you have to go on the dole, or you have extreme sickness, what do you do then? How do you practice then? Well, I think what's very important is to develop a foundation, and within that foundation, have some sense of trust and faith. What can you trust in? What can you have faith in? And what kind of foundation can you develop? That is a foundation for freedom. That is a foundation which can deal with the life in extremes. And so my own training as a monk is the only thing I can really reflect on. And some of the things, say, that we are encouraged to do are very, very simple things. You know, very simple things. And they're things that we are kind of asked to do continually, just day in and day out, day in and day out. They're not very exciting, not at all. They're not kind of experiences that we're trying to get, but they're rather training. And that's the word that we use in say, for monastic life, that this is a life of training. You're in training. And one of the monastic life is based on one of the words we use is santiti, which is contentment. Now, obviously if you're content, you're peaceful. But to actually train in contentment, to actually do that as a deliberate intention, and as a deliberate effort, in the way you're living your life, takes mindfulness, takes some energy. So how do you practice contentment? So for us, say, as monastics, we are, I live a much more simple life than you. For most of you, I think it's somewhat complex, but it's much more simpler. But just like we're asked to contemplate the food we eat, because we're offered food. We don't cook the food ourselves, and we don't have money, we can't grow food, so we live a very kind of dependent existence. And our contemplation is to be content with the food that's offered. And this is not a demand, you should be grateful. It's not that. It's not an egotistical demand. It's not like you should be content. But it's rather to contemplate contentment, to bring that up into the mind. And this is the whole training in the Buddhist way, is this use of skillful means, developing wholesome attitudes, and training in that and moving the mind towards that. So, say that the food is offered, and we look at the food, and our contemplation is that gratitude for the offerings, that the lay people have offered this food, and then this is good enough to take me through for the day. The food is medicine. It's not for pleasure, not for fun. You're not here to eat eclairs. This isn't the holy life to eat oranges all day or whatever. It's just to take care of the body for a day. Now, that's the contemplation. What the mind does, the mind says, well, actually, I would like an eclair, thank you. Or I like more oranges. Or I want brown rice. I don't want white rice. I don't want tea. I want coffee. Now, the mind might do all of that, and it sometimes does. But the reflection is, well, that isn't conducive to enlightenment. Don't have faith in that. Don't put your trust in that. Put your trust in it's good enough for the day. So it's like a mirror to discontent. It's not, and it's very important. It's not saying you should be content. It's not that. You know, it's not that. It's just saying, this is good enough for the day, which then becomes a mirror for discontent. Now, the discontent might be quite strong. So what I experienced in my first years in Thailand was a lot of craving for food, because partially had no distraction, but also I was having difficulty just to absorb different kind of diet. It took me about 2 years to adjust. So you know, the body would complain, and then my mind would complain. But the training is always like, yeah, but it'll take you through to tomorrow. You won't drop dead. It'll be all right. The people are offering it. Be grateful for it. And that, so what I find with that kind of training is then around things like food, the mind becomes more and more wholesome, because the mind's attitude then to food isn't one of greed, but of gratitude. It isn't one of greed, but of contentment. Now, that doesn't come automatically. It doesn't come to saying, I will be content. I'll put on the brown robe and I'll just be content about everything that everyone gives me. Thank you. Well, no way. Because the mind has greed, and the mind has preferences, and the conditioned mind, you know, it has all those things in it. So to actually train the mind in that way, to do that day in and day out, day in and day out, and day out, it's not like an experience of enlightenment, but is the foundation for enlightenment. And it's something that you can trust in. You can trust in that. That's something you can have faith in, contentment. Huh? Now, I'm talking at the inner level. I'm not talking at the political level. And whenever I say this, people say, what about so on and so forth? But I'm talking about the inner level, to somehow find peace within the way things are, and then to act socially the best you can for a better world. So I'm not talking about complacency. I'm not talking about condoning things. I'm just trying to give an example of trust and training, faith and training, developing the human mind in a certain way. Sense restraint is another thing that is very much emphasized in our training. Sense restraint means a kind of limiting of the whole tendency to fill the mind with sense experience, to distract the mind. Now, this isn't making any kind of moral judgment about sense consciousness, but what happens if we don't practice some sense of boundaries and some sense of restraint? Then what we tend to do is we tend to fill the mind with a lot of ideas and experiences. And if we're unskillful in that, we can do it skillfully, but if we're unskillful, then our minds become kind of log-jammed. They become kind of constipated with, or jaded maybe, with a lot of noise, a lot of experience, and the essential silence of the mind and the deep compassion of the heart can be sort of clouded. It can be kind of overlaid because it's busy. It's busy, it's caught up. So sense restraint is something you can train in. And notice that a lot of people like don't read newspapers, or they limit the amount of television they want, or they don't watch television at all, and so on and so forth. Now that's not a big deal, but you can see how if you train in that, and if you have some kind of self-discipline around that, that's going to have a calming effect if you do it well. If you do it as some sort of hatred of sense experience, then that's not peaceful. It's not so much hating sense experience, but just realizing that if we're always just filling the mind, and if we're always busy looking out, we never look in. And if we don't look in, we can't really discover true peace, the true silence of the mind. Yeah. And that, I think, comes as a natural thing for most people who meditate. Just the busyness and noise and confusion of an overly indulged sense life is unacceptable. So many of us find like walks in nature. And notice how like a walk in nature has a different effect, at least for me, because it's not so much that I'm filling my mind, but I'm allowing my mind to be one with nature. It's different than sort of reading something exciting. Or listening to something exciting is a different kind of effect. Nature has that. Nature has that kind of calming and peaceful effect. So that's something that you can have faith in, you can trust in. A kind of limiting of sense experience. Obviously, what is very important is having trust and faith in morality. This is prerequisite to any kind of minimal spiritual development is morality. There's a great story from the BBC. I think I've mentioned this here, but the BBC ran a program on the Mille massacres. Is that what they're called? About 25 years ago, you know, the American involvement in Vietnam. They had this massacre of a Vietnamese village. And BBC did this program. I don't know if it showed in North America, but in it they took two soldiers who were part of that battalion, and they interviewed them. I didn't see this; I was told about it. But one of them had gotten, and they're from the south. They're very poor, both not very. Not very educated. One of them had gotten caught up with a killing and had just got caught up with bloodlust, basically, and the excitement of killing, and had just gone for it and killed a lot of people. The other fellow shot his gun into the ground. He refused to participate. The guy that had done all the killing was, you know, he was on all kinds of uppers and downers and alcohol and smoking grass and doing everything to try to obliterate the awful memories of his mind. Had tried to commit suicide, was a really in very, very bad shape. The other fellow had shot into his ground, his mind was quite clear. And so the interviewer asked the guy who had got caught in the bloodlust, he said, why did you do it? He said, I couldn't help it. Everyone was doing it. I got so excited. It was so exciting. I couldn't help it. The guy who hadn't shot, he asked him, and he said, I knew it was wrong. I just knew it was wrong. I couldn't do that. And that conviction, he had faith in morality, didn't he? And he wouldn't do it. He just shot into the ground. And that's a very extreme example. But it is a kind of important example that we do trust and have faith in that which is good. That which is moral, that which is decent. This is very, very important. So that if society goes to a kind of any kinds of extremes, that we just don't participate in that, refuse to participate in that. Or if our mind goes to those kinds of extremes, because our human mind has the potential to do all kinds of things. And when life gets extreme, becomes extreme, then those temptations might arise through anger or through whatever. So the moral precepts of non-violence, of impeccability, of not stealing, of being faithful in relationships, of using language which is harmonious rather than hurtful, and not just getting drunk or things like that. These are a very important foundation, and they're kind of something you can have faith in, can't you? You can trust that. So if your mind says, cheat, steal, kill, whatever, say, yeah, but no. I hear you, but no, I don't trust you. I don't trust that in my mind. I don't trust that energy. I don't trust that. I have faith in goodness. So that doesn't mean that goodness is always going to come up into consciousness. Evil can come up into consciousness because it's a part of human nature, or just the nature of being. It will come and it will go. But we don't have trust in that. We don't have faith in that. We have faith in morality. One of the things that I've one of the things I'm extremely grateful for in my life is a very disciplined development of meditation. That's been my good fortune as a monastic. But I haven't found meditation easy. I'm not kind of a natural that sat on the cushion and then just sort of lifted off. I've always found it difficult, actually. I get very little bliss. I read about it. And I hear Ajahn Sumedho talking about his bliss. I get very little bliss. My mind is peaceful, but it's gone through a lot of turmoil, a lot of physical pain, a lot of boredom, predominantly, and so on and so forth. But what I can just share with you is just that, like my monastic life basically has been sitting at least morning and evening, and I mean I have the time to do that, so I'm very fortunate. And like Ajahn Chah would say, if you want to meditate, meditate. If you don't want to meditate, meditate. So just do it. And what I've found from doing that is like there's been a lot of meditation which I just haven't wanted to sit on that cushion. You know, if it really restless or just fed up or bored. But there's something about just sitting and observing consciousness, not even like doing any particular kind of technique, but just sitting and observing consciousness both purifies the mind and edifies the mind. I find those two things. Both just stopping, and I talk about this often, just stopping and allowing things to become conscious is a way that I get in touch with things that are accumulating in consciousness. Like if I'm getting really like worn out in the monastery or getting uptight about something or whatever. So there's that, so that it edifies me. It also gives insight into how things work. Just observing. There's something about that. Connections are made. Insight arises. And it's a purifying thing. It's stopping and allowing things to become conscious. It's like homeopathy, actually. In homeopathy, the way it works, they give you a remedy, and they kind of increase the fear or the rash or whatever, right? And then tends to release it. Well, it's the same meditation, but you get it in homeopathic doses rather than nervous breakdowns. But it's true, because quite often when you meditate, you don't get nice experiences. You quite often get the rubbish. You know, the rubbish is being emptied out. So you think, and that's what makes meditation often difficult, that kind of negative part of it. But I can, you know, I have a lot of faith in that now, and I trust in that now, because I've been doing it, and it has a good effect. It has a very good result, both edifying and cleansing the mind. And I do find that if I don't, like when I'm traveling, and do a lot of traveling for the next few months, when I'm traveling a lot, if I don't do regular sittings, or if I don't just go to the silence of the mind, doesn't mean I have to sit cross-legged, but if I'm in a plane, say if I'm in a plane, to spend some time, just like I use earplugs, and I sit and I just listen. I listen to the sound of the engines. But I really just try to get my mind in listening consciousness and spend some of that time, rather than just reading books, meditating. You know? Or in an airport. Or waiting for the dentist. Just kind of, and I do that a lot, because I do that a lot, just those little breaks in the mind. You're waiting for the dentist rather than picking up woman's own, that's the only thing our dentist has is woman's own, so that helps. But just like not just distracting the mind. You know, when you get to a place and you've got nothing to do, then you want to do something. Look at a magazine, or there's a Monet, yet another Monet replica, or you know, have this. You know, so we're always kind of looking, and that's what we talk about sense restraint, where you know, rather than just doing, look, you stop. What is it like now? What does my body feel like now? What's happening in my mind? It's kind of taking stock. Now that's something you get a faith in, and that's something you can do continually. You know, and just like little bits. Little bits, again and again and again, taking stock. In Buddhism, we would say that the real problem that humanity suffers from is ignorance. It's not that we are evil, because we are neither good nor evil. We have potentials. We have possibilities, and it's ignorance that is the problem. And ignorance, I often contemplate the word ignores. When I ignore something, you know, that's when ignorance is going to function. And all of us have maybe seen, like, you might be trying to write a paper or something, and there's something distracting, right? Some kind of noise. And you don't want to, you want that noise to stop, because you want to concentrate. And you're getting irritated, and eventually you either yell, or you throw a cup, or you look at it. And it's that ignoring part. When I ignore something, I'm not paying attention to it, that's where the problems arise. And what we often ignore are the negative things. We don't want them, so we tend to distract. But to pay attention, to bring forth the kind of feelings that we're having, the negative feelings, is this sense of purifying. And so if you're developing meditation, and you're sitting, and you feel restless, or you feel negative, don't see that as being wrong. Have faith and awareness. And that's the ultimate faith in Buddhism, is to really have faith and awareness. And awareness is a very, very present thing, isn't it? Like, you don't do awareness tomorrow. It's not something like you say, well, it's not like an experience that you're going to get. It's not limited to any kind of physical or mental experience. It's knowing how things are. And that's the ground faith that we have to have in Buddhism. The basic faith in Buddhism is the faith in awareness. Now, you get, like I've often had many kind of states of mind and emotional things that, when they're difficult, or when they're negative, or when they're in the extreme, quite often my faith wavers then. The faith in awareness, say. The faith in morality has always been strong. The faith in the teaching strong. But just the faith in awareness, just to be aware of this, just the way it is. Just without a comment, without a judgment, without saying I'm right or wrong, you know, without any addition, just to be totally, fully aware of it. Quite often I lose my faith. I have in the past. I have more faith now. And I begin to think and analyze and judge and blame and so on and so forth. And I more and more I do that, the less I don't have faith in that now. I used to kind of think a lot about it. But I find now that I tend to make it very complex then. It's very, very complex. I get very clever analyses of why I'm screwed up or whatever. I could have all kinds of clever reasons why I'm angry or fearful. But in the end, what I have faith and what I find most powerful is, this is the way it feels now. That doesn't sound like much. But I find that the most profound thing. If I can fully awaken and welcome into consciousness what I'm feeling, then I find things tend to get resolved. They don't maybe get resolved right away, but I see them resolving and kind of going into the peace of the mind more and more. And awareness is that it is a kind of, I think that's why I use words like caring and compassion and love and those kinds of things, because awareness has to have the sense of welcoming something or allowing it to be there in full presence. We say pure presence is ever transcending. You know, when you are purely present, without thought, without analysis, without judgment that you're right or wrong, without blame, pure presence, pure awareness, then you begin to transcend that very negativity, that very difficulty, because it has a chance to go away from you. You're not it. You don't identify with it. You don't lay claim to it. You don't proliferate on it. You don't create on it. But when you ignore it with distraction, or when you blame yourself for it, or when I blame others for it, that's ignorance. It's not pure awareness. And I tend to complicate the whole thing. And I tend to keep it going in the mind. And it's this pure awareness, which is very difficult, it's very simple, but very difficult in some way. And partially, I think, because we're so complex. We often don't take things in face value. We get caught up into the doubts. We think there's something wrong with us. And then we often set up a program of how we're going to change. So then we start making a lot of effort to become better people, which is wonderful, but often it fails. You know, you feel anger, and then you make a project to, I'm not going to get angry in the future. I refuse to get angry. I'm going to be a loving person all the time. And then you kind of control things for a while, and then you blow up, get angry, and say, I must be a better person. I'm a terrible person for being angry. And you have these kind of projects in time. But Buddhist freedom is about here and now. So the moral precepts and the instructions about right speech and so on are not to harm other beings, to live in the world in a decent way. But with pure awareness, you're beginning to see that you are neither angry or frightened, but these are simply conditions that come and go. And that's where you find the deepest love of the heart, that kind of pure awareness, because it can accept all things. Now, one of the questions last week was, what happens when we get overwhelmed? The whole thing of extremes. Like, what happens when I get overwhelmed with things? Well, what I like to do is I like to set up mirrors. I like to set up suggestions in my mind which help me to see the kinds of things I tend to get overwhelmed with. So one of the things I've often talked about is like cynicism. Cynicism, criticism, that kind of mind I've suffered a lot from. It's known as a killjoy kind of mind state. And I unfortunately developed it very well in university. And I found it very difficult not to fall into cynical states of mind. I still find it difficult. Right? And all my good intentions, I say, well, I won't be cynical today. And lo and behold, the habit grabs my mind. So I could, you know, I could kick myself for that, and that doesn't help. But how can I do that? How can I awaken to a very, very deep-rooted pattern? How do I do that? And that's really the nitty-gritty of our spiritual life. It's those really difficult patterns, I think. So what I found is if I created somehow its opposite as a mirror, you know, so I'd like this practice. May I be well, may all beings be well. Make that very, very strong in the mind, and that creates a kind of different atmosphere in the mind. A different atmosphere in the mind. And then when my mind falls into criticism, cynicism, and that, then I notice it more. It still does that. It's still the habit of that. Or like doubt. Doubt and lack of confidence. Well, I'll just use a word like trust. I'll just say trust. Of course, my doubting mind, what are you going to trust in? And I said, just trust. What are you going to trust? Just trust. And then that becomes a mirror for doubt. Now, I'm not saying that doubt isn't there, or fear isn't there, or anger isn't there, but when I see them, if I see them arising in my mind, right, and I notice that as unskillful, and I say, just be patient, it'll change, and I'm able to be with it, then the whole habit begins to die. The whole tendency towards that negativity begins to die. Huh? But I need to awaken to it. If I'm asleep to it, if I ignore it, it just keeps getting me, doesn't it? It keeps grabbing my consciousness. And I'm in the middle of it, and then I wake up. But you can only start practicing where you wake up. You know, so if you get overwhelmed, that's all right too. If you get overwhelmed really badly and you break the precepts, well, you're going to have to pay a price. There's a cost. You know, that's the way it is. But you can only begin right away. You can only begin, where you wake up. So we're trying to wake up all the time. But when we do get overwhelmed, that what we can do is make our intentions pure. That we can do. And that we can have faith in. You can't predict what's going to happen to your mind, but you can develop wholesome intentions. And that's what karma is based on. Intention. So I can, even though I might get overwhelmed by some of my habits, I can say, I'm going to try to be awake to that. I'm going to try not to pursue that particular kind of mood because it leads me to suffering. Or I'm going to try to cultivate that which is wholesome. And that kind of, like I like to wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to try to be a good monk. They're not a big deal. But it's a wholesome intention so that when I lose it in some way or I'm unskillful, then, well, that wasn't my intention. I'm not doing that on purpose. And then I reaffirm that intention. That's something I can do. That I have faith in. I don't have faith in the mind which tends to just judge me all the time. I do it, but I don't have faith in it. It happens, right? That kind of Viradhamma, you should be better mind. It happens, but I don't trust that. I don't have faith in that. But I have faith in, like, this day, I'll try to be a blessing to all sentient beings. Now, it sounds pretty high-minded, but why not? You know, I could say, I'm going to try to be a creep to all beings. You can do that, too. But that's not very inspiring for me. Now, it doesn't mean that I am a blessing to all beings at all times, but if I get overwhelmed, I can really reflect. I can say, well, you know, I didn't really mean to do that. I can apologize, yeah, but then I can say, well, that's just karma. That's just the conditioned mind. It does that. You know, it's not me, essentially. Not who I really am. And that way I can train. I can train. And Buddhism is this kind of skillful means, developing the wholesome, abandoning the unwholesome. Little things at a time. And the more you do it, the more you do that little kind of work, then the rest seems to take care of itself. Insights come. You tend to respond to the needs of society and your family better and better because you've done the kind of homework, you've done the groundwork. And these are simple things like faith and, you know, trust in things like simplicity and renunciation and mindfulness and morality. These are things we can have faith in. And it doesn't mean you have to be a kind of a card-carrying Buddhist. It's not that either. It doesn't matter what you label yourself. You don't need a label. But, you know, like having faith in wholesomeness. And then not having faith in that which is unwholesome. Not having faith in the mind which is putting you down all the time. Putting yourself down. Or the mind which is putting others up down all the time. Not having faith in the mind which always wants more and more and more and more. Not having faith in that. Yeah. And that, you know, you see by experience what leads to peace and what doesn't lead to peace. But the whole sense. So then the doubting mind, you know, then you begin to have a way of working with the doubting mind. If you have no sense of faith, no foundations, no boundaries, none of that, then the doubting mind just keeps swinging you around. You can always come back to awareness, no matter how good or bad the situation is. You can always come back to that very simple statement, this is the way it is now. This is the ultimate mantra. This is the way I feel now. And the more you cultivate that, the more you see that that pure presence is ever transcending. It's not denying, but it means you get out of samsara. You get out of this whole tendency to get caught up with things. You know, you find that transcendent peace. All right, I'll leave that to contemplate. Does anyone have any questions or any comments? Anything to share? Anything? I find that's a praise and blame is a very, very good one to see how the sense of self gets born. So first of all, to kind of realize that the sense of self is something that rises and ceases. It's not a permanent thing. So if I praise you, right, then a certain sense of self arises and a certain kind of relationship to me. And then if I blame you, then a certain sense of self arises, a defensive self, right? And our relationship changes. So that's interesting to see that, you know, you are neither one of those, that they're simply contingent on factors. So this is called dependent origination, paticca-samuppada, where, you know, the sense of self is something that comes and goes. So when defensiveness arises, then you want to do is begin to get to know that. Right, so you can go find people to insult you, I suppose, but what you can do is you can try to kind of suggest to your mind, I'm going to try to notice how the initial feelings of defensiveness or whatever happens to me when I get criticized, fairly or unfairly. So you make that intention. I'm going to use that very situation as a practice rather than the idea that there's something wrong with feeling defensive. You see, because it's not you. It's just the conditioned mind, and that's the way it reacts. So then you got some chance of being aware of it as it's arising. If you get overwhelmed by it, you get really defensive, and then you walk away, and 10 minutes later you realize, God, blow it again. In that moment, don't get self-critical. But just come back to pure awareness and say, this is what it feels like to get lost in that feeling of defensiveness. So you're reestablishing awareness, and you're also reestablishing the kind of yucky feeling of getting caught by something. So now that's not egotistical in the sense of it's not like I'm a terrible person for doing that, but it's awareness. And what it connects you to is the suffering you get when you attach to something unwholesome. And you don't want to suffer. You want to be free from suffering. And if you really feel that, and now keep it simple, don't think about it, just feel it, then the next time it comes, that'll be like a memory. That will be a memory in your consciousness that when you put your hand in the fire, you get burnt. Don't put your hand in the fire. And that, done over, you know, continuously, you do keep doing that kind of training, then you become more and more mindful of that particular mindset. And then eventually, as the defensiveness is there, you just feel it. And then that's just the way it is. And then it lasts as long as the kind of karmic habit is there. It's not, you know, it's neither right nor wrong. It just is the conditioned mind reacting that way. So you see it as an area to train, to be aware. But the two things for me is the intention to awaken, rather than the judgment that you shouldn't be like that. That's important, because you're not like that. It just is. And then the watching of the result. And that you can apply to any habit. Any habit. Especially the result part, you know, like remorse is a very good teacher. But guilt is very destructive. So I define remorse as the natural wholesome feeling of pain when this being has somehow inflicted pain on other beings. Guilt I define as self-view, self-flagellation, bound up with self, with ego. And I don't find that helpful because it just recreates more anger and aversion in my own heart. Whereas remorse brings me to compassion and to a sense of caring and so on. In Buddhism we say without remorse should be a monster, would be monster. So remorse is a good thing, but guilt is not wholesome. To awaken to it, yeah, to recognize it. And then just to trust that in awareness that's all you gotta do. Yeah. That's for the trusting part. Yes.
Another habit, so maybe your situation is similar, but if you have any comments that would help with dealing with numbness. Numbness is a habit that's sort of a zoning comfort level.
Emotional numbness. Mental. Do you notice when you're not numb?
Sometimes. I more remember the past times when I thought I wasn't numb. That is where I took in more sensual.
You appreciate a sense consciousness more?
Yeah.
More sharpened kind of awareness.
Yeah.
Well, Buddhism talks about suffering, okay? So is numbness a suffering, or is suffering not wanting numbness? So that's the bottom line. You know, you can like I know, say if I do a long retreat, my senses can be very, very, very heightened, you know. Because to some extent there's a certain amount of sense deprivation, I suppose. But that can be very, very heightened. But if I've had if I've been processing a lot of information and so on, my senses can be quite dulled. To arise, right? Then I would look at like places of non-numbness in my mind or maybe where the mind is going the other way. So like I try to notice like non-anger, and then I notice anger better and so on. So that's one thing to work with its kind of non-aspect or the negative or its opposite. If it's around like the heart and the emotions, then I found just very helpful to get out of thought and contemplate the heart chakra, to physically walk around from here and here rather than from here, literally, you know, and that took a lot of intention to come, you know, to get alive below here. You know, like Ajahn Chah used to say to all the Western monks, you guys have stupid feet. Because we'd be walking around barefoot in the monastery and always stubbing our toes. And, you know, we'd all just kind of really, you know, Buddhism, oh my toe. So, so I found that really woke me up a lot to all the emotions from the stuff Joe did, but just being aware of the body more, that was very good, especially this area and the horror, you know, so I could notice negative and positive emotions that way. But you know, like in terms of sense consciousness, sometimes the senses are acute and sometimes they're not. But where you get, I think, the most clarity is the sense of stopping in stillness and just saying, this is the way it is now, and waiting. Because the desire mind is always trying to get some kind of experience, right? So it's always looking for something like happy or exciting, and there's a kind of need for more and more extremes of it, I suppose. So, you know, you move from having a little toy car to bungee jumping in your life. You know, you got to up the ante all the time to get excitement. This is the way sense consciousness works. Or you change it all the time. But the kind of receptivity of the mind, which isn't dependent on desire, you know, like to be in a field and just let the field come to you rather than trying to find the perfect color, to let the subtlety of the field come, or just to feel the wind, or just to observe a carpet, the color of the carpet. It's a kind of waiting and being receptive and allowing the experience to be there rather than to grasping a heightened kind of sense experience. And we're very much conditioned to, you know, changing the knob of the television and stimulating all the time, which leads to a kind of jaded mind. Right? Whereas in the silence of the mind, the quietness of the mind, the attitude is more of waiting and receiving. And then you do go through kind of dull patches and so on, and you think there's something wrong. But I tend to just trust, so this is what it feels like to be dull. This is what it feels like to be numb and so on. And just to bear with that, try to witness that, not fall asleep, but bear with it. Then it tends to go in back to the silence of the mind, and then there's a lot of clarity. So there's many things around, you know, around numbness and so on. What you do is make it an object of investigation. Well, I'm going to really investigate. What do I mean by numbness? Is it physical? Is it around senses? Is it emotional? And the more you bring up that sense of inquiry, not through analysis, don't try to figure it out. Let your intuitive heart figure it out. By observing, what do you mean by that? Because there's something in you that, you know, if you ask that kind of question, it's important for you. I can't answer it really, but those are good questions in the spiritual life, because it's, you know, it's saying something. And then make it a subject of awareness rather than a subject of analysis. And then I think things tend to open up that way. Right. Yes?
I wonder if you might comment further on your remarks around deeply rooted issues, negative patterns, particularly in light of Western traditional therapeutic approaches, where what is
I've never followed that, but I certainly know that a lot of my patterns are childhood conditioning, right? I can't speak with any confidence about therapeutic approaches. But what I can see is that I have seen with the practice of awareness, as I talk about it, that some monks haven't been able to touch deep-rooted problems. You know, I can think of one monk who was abused as a boy, and he never got a hold of that for many years through awareness. And then he disrobed, and then he went into therapy, and that became more conscious and began to understand it. Then the habits were there. He still had to resolve it, and then awareness clicked in. And that whole awareness practice was really, really useful. So I'm not saying that awareness is the be-all and end-all of practices. What I would be wary of in Buddhist, in the Buddhist way of things, is that you don't create a personal, you don't identify to personal history. The personal history conditions the present moment, certainly, but that you don't create a self around that. And this is the teaching of anatta, is you know, of not self, is that these things are dependently originated. That's not who you really are. So a wrong view approach to these things, that I am someone that was abused, and you deeply believe that, whereas the Buddhist view would be with, because there was abuse, there is these frightening states of mind, or these angry states of mind, or whatever. With this, there is that. There's a kind of cause and effect relationship. That might be sound like mincing with words. Certainly, there's individuality that comes through. But where I would be concerned is you create a whole sense of self around that. That would be, in my understanding, not helpful. And yet, honor the individuality and work with that. And that's one of the complex parts of modern spirituality, is that you have, you know, things like homeopathy, which deal with deep-rooted emotions. You have mediumistic things. You know, you have Reiki. You have therapies and so on. So that can be quite a difficult one. I remember one woman who she knew she was abused as a child, say. And she was a therapist, and she worked with child abuse and all that. And for 7 years, she had been trying to get at the memory, and she couldn't. And I said, just give up. Just know that happened, and these are the conditions. And she found that very, very, very helpful. Whereas this monk, he didn't know where his confusion was coming from. He hadn't identified, hadn't become conscious. And he had his father committed suicide after, very complex. Yeah, so I'm not, no answer really. But I think in the end it's like trusting who you're working with, that the person has compassion, that the person doesn't create a strong sense of self in you, and basically that it works. That it actually liberates your heart. I think no matter what, whatever conditioning you have, once you understand the patterns, I think awareness does work, because you know them. You're not repressing them. You're not denying them. You're not distracting them. If you're not awake to them, you can't work with it. You have to awaken it somehow. You have to make it conscious somehow. But it's a hot potato in the monastery. We're always. We had a Jungian therapist come in and just do group work with us, to see how we were communicating. That was very interesting. That was really. But not Jungian. Gestalt. Yeah. But that really fit with our way of making things conscious. She was very skillful at making things conscious, making them aware. Very aware. So if someone helps you to become conscious of things and be aware, then that would be very much in the Buddhist way. What are your reflections around that? How do you see it?
Well, I agree that it's easy to develop a persona. Or what you might uncover as you progress to higher level. This becomes what I refer to as comfort with you, what believer. It's your identity. Uh-huh. And that's probably the hardest thing to escape. Because letting go of that too means nothing. You see?
Uh-huh.
But also on the other side of it, it's also a great opportunity to jump into nothingness and to see what happens. But it's difficult. We have things like false memory syndrome now that's cropping up. Uncovered are no longer valid, So the two sides of this argument.
More complexity.
The other side needs to be dealt with, other than what's far more important, it seems to be the emotion itself.
Yeah.
Rather than the specific incident.
Rather than the storyline.
Yeah. And that needs to be, and I really like the approach that because that happened, this is what's happening. Attaches the persona from the event.
Yeah.
Probably makes it easier to address, but it's the getting back to what's behind what's currently manifest. And that's what I find.
Because like Buddhist analysis always is like just to know thought is thought, feeling is feeling, body is body. So it really kind of says, like, don't worry about the storyline. But there are some, some few texts which say, yeah, if you don't know where it's coming from, then analyze it. There's a few things like that. They're vague mentions and so on. But it's interesting how that new twist on memory retrieval is making it even more complex, isn't it? It's a tough one, our society, very complex. Yes, Nalini. Into it. I think if you're conscious of something, but like my friend, the monk. You see, his intentions were being motivated by things he wasn't awake to. That's where the difficulty is. So you could say, yeah, it's his karma, but what was happening was he was getting overwhelmed by wrong intentions. And he wasn't aware of them. He wasn't awake to them. Once he awoke to the pattern, and then, okay, that was my karma, and accept it and deal with the problem, that, and so on. But it's when you can't be conscious of something, then it's very difficult. When it's so hidden. And that's the best, I think, of Western therapies, that they help people to become conscious of things. That's what I find, like the Buddhist therapists that we use in the monastery. Often when we feel limited, we have friends of the monastery that are therapists that come for retreats. We send people to them. And that's what they're doing. They're just trying to make things conscious. But they have all the tools because they've been trained in that. I haven't been trained in that. But they also have the Buddhist background. So it's quite a... We make a kind of good partnership, in the monastery. Nina? So do I. If you start to look at that realm, we'll get very confused. Because personally, I don't know, and it's the most difficult question in Buddhism, right? But if you just look at the mind this lifetime, and you see that when I've yelled at someone unfairly, that gives a result to the mind of maybe alienation from the person, that way you can see karma. That way you can notice with some kind of an action, you get some kind of result, cause and effect. And that you can verify. That you can verify for sure. And that's basically what you can work with, because you can only work with the present moment. And so even though I might have habits and conditions from who knows where, I don't know where they come from, I can only work with right now, being mindful and trying not to recreate delusion around them. And then that's what I can work with. And those kinds of questions are the unanswerables. I mean, I'm sure you can get a clever answer, but you'll go away with a clever question, I'm sure. So if you just work with what's going on now, and not to deny that or whatever, but just to work with now, then you can see how it works.
And
That's Zen. Ajahn Chah met him with a joke. One of those, yeah. Anyone else? Anything? Yes, sir.
You started with the story of the Thai people lifting the Buddha up and just going for it.
Yeah.
And all the Westerners arguing. And I'm wondering where the positive place in Buddhism is for going for it, or for risking, or for all of the exhilaration that Westerners can get attached to and caught up in.
Oh, yeah. Well, I like in just developing meditation, you got to go for it. If you doubt, you can't, you know, if you start thinking, should I, maybe, well, this posture, 10 minutes or 5 minutes, breath, you're done. So you got to go for it, you know. Like, and then meditation is that. We just got to train your mind that way. So what we try to balance, like, we try to balance the effort and intelligence. Too much intelligence, you just doubt. Too much effort, things are a mess. You know, so you see that as types of people. You see some people are incredibly clever. We had one guy who had very, very clever ideas about mulching all the leaves and branches in our forest. We have 110 acres of forest, you know. And he studied this for 6 months. Came one day with his mulcher, lasted 2 hours, and went home again. So, you know, he's just kind of incredible mind, incredible idea, but he couldn't act. He was crippled by his intelligence. And then you see other people, you know, say, hey, let's build a chair. Crash, the chair built, you know, the chair falls apart. So I think for all of us, we have to find our own balance in that way. So people who are, tend to be depressed or, you know, too much in dull states, they just have to put more energy forth. So go for a run or jump off a cliff or whatever, you know. But other people who just do that compulsively all the time have to, you know, just let it sit still. You stop, wait, contemplate. Why do you, you know, why are you running? Think about it a bit. So definitely, that's an important part of it. And then, like, yeah, like service. That's where, you know, you kind of get a lot of energy just to go. Like, I've been involved in the creation of several monasteries, and I've really often had to be the kind of character said, let's go for it. And it's been really hard because there's a lot of, oh, I don't know. Oh, are we going to pay for the mortgage? I don't know. And I, you know, I've just, you know, I've had that energy. And it was appropriate. I felt it was appropriate because it wasn't just an ego trip. You know, I knew it wasn't just for me. It was for the community and good results from that. But then also I've had, you know, kind of go for it from the ego trip, which are disastrous. So if it's based on generosity and goodness and creating something for the universe, it can be a very important part of our life. Kiwis are great for that. I learned that in New Zealand. All right, shall we cash in our chips? So thank you for your attention, and I'll be here in mid-February again. Did you have an announcement? Well, a couple of announcements. Yeah, that's why some time when we stop and we just look is so important. You know, when we're not filling the mind, when there's just space, and we're observing, what's the karmic result? Very important. That's what our society doesn't give us. Or at least that's what we've somehow lost touch with, I guess.
I ask because I'm going to realize that Yeah, that's what burnout is. So that's when, you know, a bit of a breakdown is good. Because it gives you time to rest. The less we, you know, senior monks and nuns, we really got to protect each other. Because we always, we have so much to do. All of us get on the edge like that. Even though we're doing sitting practice. So we're always looking out for each other. Diana. To create calm and brightness. Or to what we want to do is to, as much as possible, have that calm, bright mind functioning all the time. Right? So, sometimes it's good to just sustain the calm and brightness so that in ordinary life, the mind has that strength. See? So it's like almost like building a muscle. So it's okay to do it quite a bit, but not as an end in itself. As an end in itself, it becomes an attachment to that because it's quite beautiful, and then there tends to be a resentment of coarseness and complexity. There tends to be an aversion or a resentment of coarseness and complexity. Mm-hmm. So you get the calm mind, you think, now I've got it, and then you go back home and there's loud things and confusion, and I'm losing it. Whereas the calm mind is simply the tool for seeing attachment to coarsening refinement, something like that. Yeah? So that's why I see it like a tool, like a flashlight. You know, that's it.